Okay, good morning, everybody. You got your last lecture today of the semester. So we're going to finish up reproductive system, then we'll do some questions, maybe a review. And let's see, today is December 7th, so we're going to finish up reproductive system. And don't forget, we do have one last test coming up. Most people are done with lab, some people aren't. So let's see, where is, oh, did I put it away already? Oh, sorry about that. Let's open it back up. So who knows when the final is? Nobody knows. All right, we're going to have a potluck, I think, in here next semester for last lecture. Okay, it's too late today. So December 12th, that is Monday, exam 5. Those are the chapters on the test. Okay? Okay, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. Yes, starting with blood vessels to the end of the class. Now, some of these chapters are really short, dinky chapters, so it looks horrendous, but it's not too bad. Oh, you're not seeing what I'm seeing. I guess it has to come over here. All right, so December 12th. Final exam at 10:30 and have 2 hours for the test, so a little bit more time, but the test is exactly like exam 1, exam 2, exam 3, and exam 4. It's the same length, just 100 questions, maybe 101, something like that, but I think it's just 100 questions. All right, and then I'll wrap things up. If you have any questions with your grade, then I'll probably put your grades in maybe by midweek of next week. If you need your grade report earlier than that, I can put it in earlier. All right, so we were going to, what did we talk about last time? We talked about meiosis, all right? And so how is meiosis different than mitosis, generally speaking? Okay, so let's start with mitosis. What does mitosis produce? Two identical daughter cells, right? So here is mitosis. Maybe I'll turn one of these little lights on over here. Looks like it just went out. All right, so mitosis takes a parent cell with how many chromosomes in the parent cell? How many chromosomes are in a normal somatic human cell? 46, but remember they're arranged as two sets of 23, 1, 2, all the way down to 23, 1, 2, all the way down to number 23. So these ones are identical, but they come from different individuals, so they carry different genes or different traits for a particular characteristic, right? So one might code for brown eyes and the other for blue eyes, and then those genes get together and produce eye color for you. All right, so these are what we call homologous chromosomes. The ones are very similar, the twos are very similar, but twos and ones are vastly different from each other. And then the very last one down over here, 23, those are the sex chromosomes. So they determine what gender you are to some degree. All right, and then with mitosis, then we end up with two daughter cells and exactly what? 46 chromosomes again, so two pairs, two sets of chromosomes over here. So if we have 46 over here and 46 over here and over here, what has to happen to these chromosomes so that when you split them apart, you still have 46? They have to replicate, right? So here is an example of one chromosome, and during interphase of the cell cycle of this cell, then DNA replication takes place, and then you end up with what we call sister chromatids. That's still a single chromosome, but there's actually two joined together. That's a sister chromatid. So that during mitosis, these things separate and we end up with the same genetic material. All right, so how do we talk about the numbers of chromosomes in this particular cell? Two different terms that we can use. We can say 2N or diploid. All right, so that's the ploidy of these cells. What's the ploidy of this daughter cell? That's diploid, right? So that's what mitosis does. All right, so don't forget about interphase. DNA replication takes place as well as other organelles get replicated. All right, now for meiosis, what happens here? You start with a stem cell or a germ cell, and instead of one round of separation, you have two rounds of separation. I made these arrows a little bit too long for what I want to do. So we have meiosis one and meiosis two. So what did we call this arrangement right here? These two things are sister chromatids. And what do we call these two chromosomes, number one and number one? The maternal number one and paternal number one. These are called, they're chromosomes, but what kind of chromosomes are these? As opposed to maternal number one and paternal number two. If they're both number ones, those are called homologous. Homologous chromosomes. All right, so can you appreciate the difference between sister chromatids and homologous chromosomes? What about number 2 over here and number 46 over here? Are those homologous chromosomes? No, it has to be like number 20 over here and number 20 over here. Right, they're going to be the same size and shape. All right, so homologous and then sister chromatids. So for meiosis, there are two rounds of separation. The first round we call meiosis 1, and what separates during meiosis 1? It is the homologous chromosomes. Right, so the number 1s are separated into two cells. So let's just say homologous chromosomes separate. All right, and so in these cells over here, I'll just kind of maybe draw a little example. So in this cell over here, we still have chromosomes existing as what? As sister chromatids. So in order to form gametes, these sister chromatids have to separate, and that happens during meiosis II. So sister chromatids separate during meiosis 2, homologous chromosomes for meiosis 1. And for mitosis, we end up with two daughter cells that are diploid. What do we end up with for meiosis? We actually get four of these. These are now gametes. And what's the ploidy of a gamete? It is haploid. Or 1N. And how many different kinds of gametes are there? Yeah. Okay. And over here, yeah, there's four different kinds of gametes, but in terms of classes of gametes, not just as a result of meiosis right here, but in life there are two, right? So there are oocytes and sperms. So those are the two. And when a sperm joins an egg, what do we call that process? That's fertilization. So here is an example of a sperm right here. And here is an oocyte. When these two join together, it produces a single cell. Does anybody know the name of this single cell? We talked about it last time. That's the zygote. All right, so the zygote is a full human cell with a full complement of DNA. So here we have gametes. You already told me that the ploidy of a gamete is haploid or 1N. All right, so then here is fertilization. So we've got 23 chromosomes here, 23 over here, and then we end up with two sets of 23 chromosomes in the zygote. So this zygote is a diploid cell. These are haploids, we call that over here. And what would this set of chromosomes be? Where did it come from? Let's not switch it on the board. Let's keep them in the same row. These are the paternal chromosomes, and these are the maternal chromosomes. Right. Okay. So since we're talking about fertilization, let's look at fertilization as shown in your book. Let me turn some of those lights back off once again. Too dark. Okay, so let's take a look at, let's review what a sperm looks like once again. And what the heck is a sperm once again? Male gamete. Okay, so here is a mature sperm. It's got a headpiece, a midpiece, and a tailpiece right here. And the tailpiece is just your typical kind of flagellum, right? And the flagellum is coordinated by centrioles that are in the headpiece right in this region right here. Centrioles are, the job of the centrioles is to build and adjust and regulate the building of microtubules inside the cell. And microtubules are the components that make up a flagellum that give it motility. The midpiece right here is the part of the sperm that mostly contains mitochondria. And what's the job of mitochondria?
Energy.
Yeah, it produces ATP, a form of energy that's used by all cells, and that ATP then enters a little bit of cytoplasm right here, and it energizes the centrioles and makes the flagellum move back and forth. And as you can see, the headpiece, which is really the major cellular part of a sperm, doesn't have very much cytoplasm. It's mostly nucleus, although it only has how many chromosomes? Only 23. Okay. And then here is the acrosome. This contains enzymes that aids in fertilization. In the cytoplasm right here, there are no mitochondria. Right? So the energy comes from the midpiece right here, so there's very little cytoplasm. It's mostly nucleus in the headpiece right here. All right, so let's now consider what's happening for fertilization. All right, so here we have an oocyte, and on the inside of the oocyte, we have the genetic material. So we have the nucleus, and there's mitochondria and other organelles. And so here I can see just a little bit of some DNA. So this is a fairly large cell, and you can almost see this oocyte with your naked eye, but not quite. So it's a very, very large cell. And surrounding the oocyte is a group of cells that we call the corona radiata. And there's a little bit of a deeper layer called the zona pellucida, and then there's some interstitial space between the zona pellucida and the oocyte. So let's zoom into this region right over here. So let's pretend we only see one sperm, because this is sort of like a time-lapse picture of what's happening. All right, so sperm swims up to this oocyte, and it's got to penetrate through the corona radiata. And it's going to bind to a receptor, okay, that's part of the zona pellucida. So here is a receptor, and so there's got to be a ligand receptor interaction, so that's how the sperm knows to attach to this particular oocyte. And then the enzymes in the acrosome start to digest away a little pathway, like a little canal through the zona pellucida into this interstitial space. And the sperm then bumps into the oocyte, and a second reaction takes place. It's called a cortical reaction. When it bumps into the plasma membrane, and there's probably receptor interactions at this point as well, there are granules right up against the plasma membrane. They become activated, and this is what we call the cortical reaction, right? So then there are enzymes in these granules that go back to the surface over here and destroy all the receptors on the surface of the zona pellucida, so that for fertilization, only one sperm is going to fertilize this egg because it destroys the receptors right here. Because otherwise, if more than one sperm can fertilize an egg, what would be the ploidy of that cell, of that zygote? Yeah, it would be 3 or 4 or 10 or something, and that would not be a viable cell. Okay, so these cortical granules destroy the receptor site so that fertilization takes place only with a single sperm. All right, then the head is engulfed by the plasma membrane, and the nucleus, right, just becomes part of the internal spaces of the oocyte. And so now you have a fertilized egg back to a diploid state. But the rest of the sperm does not enter the oocyte, including these mitochondria, because the oocyte has its own mitochondria and organelles. So in terms of mitochondria, what do you inherit? Where do these mitochondria come from? What kind of mitochondria does a zygote have? Only maternal mitochondria, not paternal mitochondria. And you're probably wondering, well, why is that kind of important? But what can you tell me about a mitochondria that we drew on the board last time? It has DNA. So anytime you do a DNA analysis inside any of our bodies, from any cells inside of our bodies, we'll find the fingerprint of our mitochondria DNA that came just from our mom and not from our dad. So you can trace maternal DNA in our bodies back through generations, but there's no chance to trace paternal mitochondrial DNA because the mitochondria never enter this cell right here, which is sort of interesting. Okay, because the mitochondria are located in the midpiece of a sperm. All right, so there are two reactions for fertilization to make sure that a sperm, only one sperm fertilizes an egg. You got the acrosomal reaction and the cortical reaction. Okay, so that's fertilization. And that produces a zygote, and then it's going to start growing right away. And it's going to start growing by which kind of process? When we say growth, what process is happening there? So first, you start with one cell, which is a zygote, and then 2 cells, and then 4 cells, and then 16, 32, and then it becomes a blastocyst. All right, and a blastocyst then can, let's look at some anatomy. A blastocyst can All right, so here is an oocyte making its way down the fallopian tube. What are the two modes of motility that a immotile egg can move through the fallopian tube? There are two things that allow it to move through a fallopian tube. So it has to do with the function of a fallopian tube. It is peristalsis, smooth muscle contractions that move the egg down, as well as cilia on these cells of that line, the fallopian tube. So both of those reasons why an egg moves down into the uterus. Fertilization usually takes place right here, and the zygote starts to grow, becomes a blastocyst, and then implantation takes place in the uterus under normal conditions. All right, so let's take a look at how the ovary and the uterus is controlled by hormones in the body. And what I have right here is a slide from another textbook that makes it pretty easy to understand. This is not an exam figure, but I'll put it in Blackboard for you to look at. And it's a really nice diagram. Because what we see right here are, first, if we just look at the horizontal axis, we just see time, right? And the cycle is 28 days long, so here are just days. And right at mid-cycle is day 14. And we can see some hormone profiles. We can see hormone profiles during the cycle from the anterior pituitary, follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone on this top graph. And then we can see some sex steroids on the bottom graph over here, and that would be estrogen and progesterone. So estrogen is kind of homologous to a male sex steroid testosterone, but there is no analog for progesterone in the male. And there's a real simple reason for that, because what is the long name for progesterone? Who can tell me what gestation is? It's the term of pregnancy, right? So progesterone is what we call progestational hormone. it maintains pregnancy. So if there's high progesterone, then the body realizes or thinks that it is pregnant, right? And so that's a circumstance that can never happen in the male, so there is no need for progesterone in the male, but of course there should be testosterone. All right, so we see two profiles of hormones through the cycle, and then we see some structures that we find in what organ. So here I see a developing follicle and a mature follicle, and then I see a corpus luteum. Where do we find these structures? Within the ovary. So this top graph right here is a depiction of the ovarian cycle, and the ovary changes every month. It goes through these changes as a result of stimulus from these hormones. And then the bottom graph over here, we're looking at the endometrium. As a matter of fact, the functional layer of the endometrium. And what organ has an endometrium? The uterus, right? So here we're looking at the uterine cycle, okay, or menstrual cycle. So the menstrual cycle involves the uterus, and the ovarian cycle, of course, involves the ovary. All right, so these two hormones right here, FSH and LH. LH is, or FSH is relatively high, and that's important because it causes the maturation of a number of follicles within the ovary. And by the time mid-cycle takes place, there's usually one follicle that reaches maturity. We call this a graafian follicle. And right at mid-cycle, then we see a big spike in FSH and even a bigger spike in luteinizing hormone. And that big spike in luteinizing hormone causes ovulation. All right, so the bullet points that I want you to know is that there's a hormone that causes the follicle to develop, and I would like you to know the name of that hormone. What is that called? Follicle stimulating hormone. So that should be pretty easy to remember. Now, maybe what's not so easy is, where does follicle stimulating hormone come from? It comes from the anterior pituitary gland, okay, and the same for luteinizing hormone. That comes from the anterior pituitary gland. Another question that I have for you is, I want you to pick one hormone that is most responsible for ovulation. And what is that? That is luteinizing hormone. So you can see this big peak right here due to luteinizing hormone. All right, so now this oocyte is free, but it can't swim around. But where should it end up if all is normal? Yeah, it should be in the uterine tube, so the fimbria should capture it, right? And then it should make its way down the fallopian tube or uterine tube. Now the rest of these cells of a follicle don't degenerate. They don't disappear. They become an important endocrine gland. And what's the name of that important endocrine gland? What does a follicle become after ovulation? It's got a name. And it looks yellow, right? So that's the corpus luteum right here. And if implantation takes place, then the corpus luteum lives, right? And it supports the endometrium. But if fertilization and implantation doesn't take place, then the corpus luteum starts to regress and die away, and it becomes the corpus albicans, which is just a little white, like almost like a cyst inside the ovary. But it continues to degenerate. All right, so this is what we call the follicular phase of the ovarian cycle, because what's happening during the follicular phase, from day 1 to day 14? The follicles are developing, so hence we call that follicular. So I do want you to know follicular is part of the ovarian cycle. And then the second half of the ovarian cycle is the luteal phase, because that's when the corpus luteum, okay, comes into being and secretes some hormones. All right, so the ovary is controlling what's happening inside the uterus. So let's go back down to the bottom table right here. And I see two hormone profiles. I see estrogen and progesterone. And during the follicular phase of the ovarian cycle, what hormone is at a high level? Okay, we see estrogen. So estrogen is being secreted by developing follicles. And as follicles grow and mature, they secrete more and more estrogen. All right, so we see an increase in estrogen. All right, but a follicle produces very little progesterone. Why during this time is there very low progesterone? Okay, there's pretty high estrogen. We'll talk about why that is. But why is there low progesterone? What's another name for progesterone? Progestational hormone. So during this phase of the ovarian cycle, there's never a pregnancy, right? So there's no reason to have progesterone. There's a little bit, right? So high levels of estrogen and very low levels of progesterone will cause the endometrium to proliferate. And if these processes that we have on the board, which one is proliferation? What do we got on the board right here? On the left we have mitosis, okay, and on the right we've got meiosis. Which one of these relate to proliferation the best? Would be mitosis, yeah, because what's one of the functions of mitosis is growth, right? And so the endometrium is growing, so cells are undergoing cell division and it's growing. The vascular supply is growing as well. Some glands are starting to develop. This is controlled by estrogen. And where does that estrogen come from? It comes from the developing follicle right here, which is being controlled by the anterior pituitary because it's releasing follicle-stimulating hormone. All right, but the most direct hormone that causes proliferation of the endometrium is estrogen, and you can see this nice arrow pointing down right here from which line? The estrogen line, right? So estrogen causes proliferation of the endometrium, and hence we call that the proliferative phase. So the phases are a little bit different when you're comparing ovarian cycle and uterine cycle or menstrual cycle. So proliferation is under the control of what hormone? Or the proliferative phase of the uterine cycle is controlled primarily by what hormone? Yeah, estrogen, and you can see that arrow right here. All right, and then ovulation takes place. Let's look back up in the ovary. Ovulation takes place. The follicle is no longer there, but something replaces it. Something now comes into being that we call the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum then stops secreting the huge amounts of estrogen as estrogen starts to decrease, and now the cells of the corpus luteum produce and secrete another hormone, which is progesterone. All right, so in combination, estrogen and increasing levels of progesterone cause the endometrium to grow and to mature, and by mature, we mean that there are glands that actually start to secrete substances, and we're not exactly sure what all these substances are, but those substances aid in implantation of an embryo into the uterus. Okay, so progesterone pretty much is in control of the secretory phase because these glands now start to secrete products into the lumen of the uterus. And the vascular supply, okay, is ready to support implantation as well. Okay, so what I want you to really appreciate in this slide right here is the ovarian cycle has two phases, follicular and luteal, right? Follicular phase is due to the development of follicles. The luteal phase is due to the development of the corpus luteum. And the follicular phase secretes estrogen. So estrogen starts to increase as follicles grow. And then when a follicle disappears after ovulation, then you get the corpus luteum and it starts to secrete progesterone to make sure that the endometrium reaches maturation for implantation. Okay, so again, on the top graph you can see FSH. So here's the FSH line with an arrow showing that it's stimulating the follicle to grow, and then in the luteal phase, right, we see that arrow is coming from luteinizing hormone, and that causes, okay, the development of the corpus luteum. Now, if pregnancy, the fertilization does not take place and implantation, then the endometrium regresses and is sloughed from the body in about 5 days of mild hemorrhage, right? So it leaves the body and the cycle can start all over again on day one. So menstrual cycle is from like day number 1 through 5 or 4, something of that nature. Okay, and the menstruation is triggered by decreasing levels of progesterone and estrogen. So if progesterone were to stay high during this period of time, okay, what would happen to the endometrium? It would not regress. All right, and so again, what is progesterone? What's another name for progesterone? It's called progestational hormone, so the body thinks it's pregnant when progesterone is really high. So how is it that the corpus luteum, okay, if implantation takes place, how is it that the corpus luteum knows to stick around and not regress? And when it sticks around, it's going to continue secreting progesterone, and progesterone actually should increase a little bit, right? So how does this corpus luteum know that there's a pregnancy? Because there's a signaling molecule, right, that's coming from the developing fetus, and in particular the placenta, right? It's not exactly the fetus, but the placenta, that goes back into the blood, goes everywhere in the body, all right? And when it bumps into the corpus luteum, what does the corpus luteum have that knows that is that the endometrium is sending it a signal, or the placenta? How does the corpus luteum know that the placenta is sending it a signal? Okay, and in a little bit, I'm going to ask what the name of that signal is. How does it know? It has the corpus luteum has receptors for that particular hormone on the cell membranes of these cells. So when that hormone binds to the corpus luteum, right, it changes the physiology or maintains the physiology of the corpus luteum, so it keeps secreting progesterone. And does anybody remember from last time what the name of that signaling hormone is that comes from the placenta that goes to the corpus luteum that tells it not to regress because human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG. And we all could take a test for human chorionic gonadotropin, because where could we pick it up? Where could we get that test? It's a fairly sensitive test. It's a pregnancy test that you can just buy in the grocery store. Okay, it measures the level of human chorionic gonadotropin, and if there's any in your body, then that's a sign that you have a viable placenta, which means what? You're pregnant. Of course, guys, I wouldn't waste my money on it, because we never have a placenta. Okay? Okay. Yeah, now I'm embarrassing everybody in here. Okay. All right, so I think there's going to be a couple questions on the test regarding these hormones right here, like LH. What does LH do? Causes ovulation. FSH causes the maturation of a follicle, and that's synonymous with what? Stimulating the secretion of estrogen. And what does estrogen do? It causes the endometrium to proliferate during the proliferative phase of the uterine cycle. And what does progesterone do? It maintains the integrity of the endometrium so that pregnancy can be maintained. All right, so what's the sex of the individual that we're talking about right here? This is a female. But I also want you to know what these hormones do for the male. What about progesterone in the male? Doesn't exist. Okay. And estrogen is replaced with what? Testosterone. You should know what testosterone does in the male. What does testosterone do in the male? Okay. It aids in spermatogenesis. Spermatogenesis won't take place without testosterone. But it also produces all the male sex characteristics, like bigger, stronger bones, typically, more muscles, larger larynx. So what happens to somebody's voice when your larynx gets big? It gets deeper as a result of that, okay? More hair all over the body, that's coarser in nature. Okay. And let's see, what about FSH in the male? Ah, you know what? Both FSH and LH do exist in the male, okay? But that might seem a little strange, because we don't really recognize any cyclic behavior, right, in the male in terms of the reproductive system. It's pretty much flat from day to day to day. But FSH and LH don't skyrocket in certain part for male, but they're still secreted. So I do want you to know what FSH is responsible for in the male. In the female, what does FSH do? It makes stimulates a mature oocyte or mature follicle. So in the male, it stimulates spermatogenesis, right? It stimulates spermatogenesis. And LH in the male, Okay, what does LH in the male do? It stimulates Sertoli cells to secrete testosterone. Okay, so FSH in male for spermatogenesis, LH for testosterone secretion. Okay, but that's it. Pretty boring in the male. One last thing that I want to mention. I'm going to turn some lights back on. I want to go back over to this board. Talked about these sex chromosomes. What number are the sex chromosomes? Yeah, number 23. And I don't think I talked about it last time. So, that's not erasing really well. So I'll go to another pen. So the sex chromosomes are number 23. All right, so here's a sex chromosome over here. And of course, we all have two sex chromosomes in our body. And we're going to call this an X chromosome. And what did we say about the shape between number one, maternal number one, and paternal number one? Same shape, right? Same, they're big chromosomes, right? Same size and shape. So, the X chromosome is a large chromosome. So what I see right here are what? How many chromosomes? I see two, and what are they? These are both X's, okay? And if you have two sex chromosomes that are both X's, that means female will develop. All right, so what's another possibility besides female? Could be male, okay? So here we have a sex chromosome. And what does this one look like? I hope you can see it. It looks like an X, right? Okay, so let's put an X right here. But now, if you're going to be a male, you got to have something different over here. Otherwise, you would be what? If it's XX, you're going to be female. So here is another kind of chromosome, and it looks like that. This one is what we call a Y chromosome. And that might be your question. You see that it's different. In what way? You can't see. Yeah, it's important. Let's see, maybe I got another marker. Right here. So we got, I can see this. Hopefully you can. Here's an X. Here is another X. All right, and then here is, what is this right here? Another X. All right, and then there's another kind of sex chromosome that we call a Y. That looks like that. What can you tell me about Y compared to X? It's a lot smaller. So it's missing all of this information right here. So the Y chromosome is missing DNA that controls all of these traits. That's a Y. So if somebody has an X and a Y chromosome, then you're a male. All right, so I just want to point this out to all you ladies in here, okay, how sensitive you should be to the male gender, because we're deficient this information, right? So you should just treat us really nice. We have a hard time with life because we're missing all of this information right here. So you ladies need some good sensitivity training. Now here's a really strange thing. We know that this chromosome is actually getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And we can surmise that someday, guess what? That Y chromosome is going to completely go away. Now, what will that mean? I'm not sure what that means. Okay, hopefully somebody has, you know, many kilos of these Y chromosomes in a jar someplace, and we're all going to be test tube babies in a million years or something. Or somebody will figure out a way to stop that process from happening. Okay, and the reason why we're really interested in that is because there are some pathologies, okay, that are produced because of these sex chromosomes right here. One pathology, it's not really a pathology, but it's an abnormal condition, and that is color blindness. The gene for normal color vision is in this part of the X chromosome. Okay, and in the Y chromosome, where is it? It's in this part that's lost, right? And usually to express an abnormal condition, you have to have the abnormal gene on two chromosomes. For instance, if it's a homologous chromosome, if the gene for color blindness was in number one, like in this location here and right here, if one gene was normal and the other was abnormal, the normal would usually be expressed. Okay, so let's just say this is abnormal and this is normal over here. The individual would have normal color vision. But in the male, you only need how many genes for abnormal color vision? You only need one. So if you have one abnormal gene, there's not a normal location, there's not a location on the Y chromosome to counteract that condition right here. And so who's going to be more susceptible to being colorblind, males or females? Males, because in order for a female to be colorblind, they need to have an abnormal gene on this chromosome as well as an abnormal gene on this one as well. Okay, so this does play some important roles in genetics. All right, so that's it for lecture, but we can do a little review for the test. If somebody has any questions, yes. They just have sites for defining different structures in your body and different traits in your body. So one chromosome can't contain enough information to define everything. So in a simple sense, maybe chromosome number one over here, and this is just really, really simple, maybe chromosome number one will define what the structure of your whole nervous system and cardiovascular system and skeletal system is, three organ systems, which is a lot of information. Chromosome number two, instead of having three or four organ systems, it might only have like one or one and a half. So it's going to be smaller. And then the ones down over here, 22, maybe they don't have information for a whole organ system. Maybe those will be just for part of an organ system. So those chromosomes are going to be a lot smaller as a result. So that's kind of an oversimplification, but just think of that the number one chromosomes contain a lot of information, so it can determine a lot of your body, how it's going to develop and grow and function. But these other chromosomes over here have a lot less information, so it's going to control fewer spots in your body as a result. Here? Okay, you do have a number one from your dad and you do have a number one from your mom. It's going to control exactly the same parts of your body, but it's going to say that part of your body is going to be different somehow. Like if it's maybe hair color, maybe from your mom, right? You're going to get something that says you're going to have black hair, but your dad has maybe brown hair. But it's still what? It's still hair. You don't have any genes for hair in any of these other chromosomes. In the simplest case, okay? I don't know, does that answer your question, sort of? Sort of, yeah? Okay, so these chromosomes determine different parts of your body, how they're built, okay? And they don't switch around. Any other questions? Any other questions? Sign-in sheet was going around someplace, probably in the back of the room. I don't know. I think you pretty much know the nephron. I don't think we need to go over that. You know, next year, oh, I do have a comment. You know, next year, I think for the last day, I'm going to say we're going to take the quiz first, the drawing of the nephron, and then take the practicum second. Because I talked to a lot of people on Monday and today that said, why is it that I can draw it out on a piece of paper perfectly, a nephron with the three processes, which I think is a pretty high-level exercise just to have that in your mind, draw it on a blank piece of paper. But when I was taking the practicum, I didn't know it. Okay, I knew it just right after the practicum. I could draw it on a piece of paper, but I didn't know it well enough to answer some of the questions on the practicum. And they're exactly the same thing, and drawing it is actually harder than just recognizing it on a model, for instance. So I don't know why that is, but I might switch that around. Does anybody have the same impression that the quiz would have helped you for the practicum? Or would have that just delayed taking the practicum and hurt you? Who knows, huh? Okay. All right. You know, there's a couple of websites where you can write down your impressions of a course. You know, Rate My Professor is one, and I don't know, a bunch of others are out there. And, you know, I usually don't read them, but students read them a lot. And so you could actually help students out that might take this particular anatomy class. So if you go and rate your professor, which would be me, one thing that I would like you to put into that website is name one or two things that helped you pass the class. All right, that would be good information to, and you know, you can say whatever you want about me or whatever, that's fine. But if you could say something that would help a student, okay, next time around, or maybe even yourself, if you have to take the class over again, you could go back and read those comments. All right, so what are some things that helped you pass the class? Okay, well, studying is really good, but would it be like videos in Blackboard for anatomy? Study guides. Okay, and, you know, end of chapter questions or figures. And maybe you can't put your finger on just one thing, so maybe put a list of things. Or if you really found listening to the lecture again in Blackboard, if that was helpful, put that down. Okay, so that you could correct your notes. So if there's some helpful hints that you could provide to other students, and of course time management is just critical, right? I'm going to really focus more on that next time because I didn't really follow up on the weekly study guide. Weekly study schedule that I gave everybody at the beginning of class. If you think that that's important, you might want to download that, just keep it for yourself and use that in some other classes that are coming up, because classes that come after anatomy are what? How would you classify courses after anatomy? They're harder, okay? They're even more hard, so you got to be even better at time management, okay? Make sure you get your study time in there well before an exam. And, of course, don't stay up all night before an exam, because exams, you should know how to think. You should be able to think, which means you good rest, more than memorize, right? Because if you're really fatigued, then even memory kind of goes out the window, right? So study well in advance. Okay, that's all I got to say, unless I got some other comments or questions. One last group has to take a practicum at noon upstairs. Raise your hand if you're taking a practicum. All right, and then you're done. Far out. Okay, I'll see you Monday.